Thank you very much, Michael. Before I forget, I've brought a few remaindered copies of the two-year-old Trilateral Commission report that Oxfam couldn't shift, so if anybody wants one, some of the underlying analysis I think is still relevant, even if parts of it are out of date. What Michael didn't tell you was that when he was Minister of State at the Northern Ireland office, his pay was so low that I had to buy his pizzas when they came into number 10, and he promised that when he could afford it, he would buy me in return dinner at Pratt's, I think it was. That was 14 years ago. Poor Michael is still struggling, but it's nice that he's given me a sandwich today, even if I have to work for it. And I look forward to that dinner, Michael. I'll wait another 14 years if necessary. I've asked two questions in my title. Is Russia a strategic partner, and is Russia a worthy member of the G8? And you could say that the answer is entirely obvious and very brief. But I think there are reasons for asking these questions at this particular time. One is that Russia is obviously now entering a new presidential term, and you can read a lot of differing impressions about the orientation of the new, or perhaps not new, regime in Russia, ranging from pro-Western liberalism, as some commentators have tagged it, to a new Cold War, as others are describing it. Then we have the European Union, which is deeply divided about what to do about Russia, but despite being deeply divided, is about to open negotiations on a successor to the 1997 Partnership and Cooperation Agreement. And that was an agreement which was based on an idea described in EU documents and EU official policy that we had with Russia, a genuine strategic partnership founded on common interests and shared values, in particular democracy, human rights, the rule of law, and market economy principles. Now, what is actually the right policy for the EU in the situation that really exists? Thirdly, in the United Kingdom, we've endured 4 years of hostility in our political relationship with Russia, and a freeze, a virtual freeze, at the top political levels. No Russian president has been here, no British Prime Minister has been to Moscow, no foreign minister has gone in either direction on a bilateral visit, as opposed to G8 or whatever, in the course of the last 4 years. Even in the Cold War, we had rather more contact than that. So what's the right approach for the United Kingdom? And then finally, the United States. They've had much more contact at the top levels in this period, but if you measure things in rhetoric, the atmosphere between Washington and Moscow has been even more vituperative than between London and Moscow. For 2 years, John McCain has been demanding Russia's exclusion from the G8. What are going to be the effects of the United States presidential elections? I want to really divide what I say into two parts. Firstly, to ask where Russia is heading, and then to turn to the question of what the West should do about it. Is Russia changing at the moment? I think the answer to that is yes and no, but in the immediate sense, more no than yes. There's one well-known pundit in Washington who, in a great gush of optimism, wrote the other day that there is new hope for Russia. Medvedev has already advanced his cause more than Putin did during his first 3 years as president. Medvedev's successful start suggests that we should expect many and substantial reforms soon. Now, I spent most of last week in Moscow, and even among the liberal supporters of the new president, I don't think I found a single person who shared that ultra-optimism of the Washington pundit. What do we actually know about Medvedev? Not a huge amount. We know that from the age of 24 onwards, effectively through his adult working life, he has been a wholly integrated member of Putin's entourage. We know that he had a law degree from St. Petersburg University, but so did Putin, from the same faculty. We know that he was not a member of the KGB, but in these 14 years, he has worked very intimately with former KGB Siniviki. We know that he was elected solely and wholly as Putin's nominee on Putin's coattails. We could surmise that Putin chose him as the candidate closest to him and most malleable by him, the only one of the likely candidates who had no independent faction, no independent power base, no previous career outside Putin's entourage. a sort of wholly owned subsidiary of Putin. The new arrangement is described officially as a tandem, but it's a tandem in which Putin is not really playing the role of number two. And in practice, if you have a tandem in a country that's got a very presidential system, that means a net loss to the presidency. And we see this happening. Putin has already transferred a great deal of power to the Prime Minister's office. He's made himself the leader of the party that dominates the Duma. He's changed the reporting lines of the 89 governors of the different regions. It's Putin, not Medvedev, who's recently set out the national strategy running to the year 2020. And then we look at the personnel changes, the new lineup, remembering that it was Lenin, I think, who said that cadres are everything. And there are very few new faces. There are very few people who are manifestly Medvedev's appointees in key positions. The nearest, I suppose, might be the new Justice Minister Konovalov, but how powerful is the Justice Minister? It's a very second-tier appointment. As Prime Minister, Putin has actually surrounded himself with a slew of the heaviest hitters from the old administration. He's brought Shuvalov, Sobyanin, Sechin from the Kremlin. He's retained people like Kudrin, Zubkov, Sergei Ivanov, Kozak, and many others. And so he's left the Kremlin team much lighter in weight than it was before, and then the team which surrounds him. Most strikingly, when you look at the Kremlin, the key position there under the president, the head of the presidential administration, is held by Naryshkin, who is somebody closely associated with and promoted by Putin. And his two most significant deputies, again, are people very closely associated with Putin. That is Gromov, Putin's former press secretary, and Syurkov, who managed politics. If you look at the top 12 in the Kremlin, only one of them can really be identified as a personal appointee of President Medvedev. That's Chuchenko, a fellow lawyer. So we don't have a new regime in Moscow. We have a continuation of Putinism, with Putin himself wielding, at this moment, more authority than President Medvedev. What we don't know is whether it's going to continue like this. Is this merely transitional? Will it change? Will Putin retain the position of Prime Minister for a long time, or will he at a certain point feel sufficiently confident to start to take a seat nearer to the back? Conversely, might he go the other way and at some point, possibly 4 years hence, return to the presidency? These are simply unknowns. If you talk to Medvedev supporters, they say that they think it'll take their man 3 to 5 years to establish his authority as president. They recall that it took Putin the better part of 3 years really to become his own man. Until we reach that point, it seems to me that any judgments that pundits might make about what kind of a person Medvedev is and what kind of an administration he might really run are simply premature. We can be encouraged that he's declared his strong opposition to legal nihilism and to corruption, that he said that he wants to establish stronger institutions and a more independent judiciary in Russia. We can feel encouraged that he's got a think tank of many of the top economic liberals, the Institute for Contemporary Development, that is feeding some advice to him. But any attempt at modernization of this kind is inevitably going to run into some immensely powerful vested interests, these interests that at the moment hem the new president in. He depends on a corrupted and recalcitrant bureaucracy and on security organs that don't feel any natural affiliation to him, and it's going to be very hard for him to move from articulation of liberal policies of the kind that he's given in his speeches to implementation unless he's able to do so with the vigorous support of President Putin. So what does that mean that we should expect from Russia over the next 4 to 8 years, the next 1 to 2 presidential terms? I think that part of the key to this is what's going to happen to the economy. We've seen how the tidal wave of money that came from oil and gas that hit Russia around 2002-2003 put an effective end at the time to reform. Russia is still awash with money. GDP grew by over 8% last year. But this money, the hydrocarbon dollars, has generated a series of problems. The ruble has strengthened, sucking in imports at a very fast rate. Corruption has reached absolutely extreme levels. Efforts to increase the efficiency and the productivity of the oil and gas industry are stalling. Actually, their production has been falling in the course of this year. And inflation is pushing up. Wages rose in Russia last year by about 27 or 28%. The headline rate of inflation is currently running at about 15% annually against a government target of 10.5%. And fuel price inflation, food price inflation are higher than the headline rate and are causing quite a lot of tensions, not unlike in other countries. The rising wealth of the past 5 years has concealed a failure to address a lot of underlying problems: the unreformed health and benefit system, the inadequate investment in infrastructure, the weaknesses nowadays in education and science, the consequences of high mortality and a falling population, the largely unreformed military, the widening disparities of income, and the problems of the poorer regions. So if you are an incoming president, or indeed an incoming prime minister, and Putin, let us remember, has set as one of his key targets reducing inflation, this is a pretty daunting agenda. So that's what the Russian administration is going to be grappling with over the period ahead. The easy times, as quite a number of people are prone to say in Moscow now, are behind them. They've had it very lucky for the last 8 years. The next 8 years are not going to be so easy. So there is a recognition in the political class that the basis of Russia's wealth is fragile, it's very narrowly focused on the energy sector, and that social pressures need to be addressed. There is a strong desire within that class, within sections of it, the more enlightened sections of it, for modernization. There is recognition that Russia needs to diversify its economy. There is a desire to make Russia a stronger player in the global economy over the next 20 years or so, to make Russia one of the world's top five economies and more than a natural resources exporter. What stands in the way of achieving that? Well, quite a lot of things. The personal agendas of many of the most powerful people in state offices, the vested interests, the mega corruption that I spoke of, the bureaucracy, and this very large state sector, added to which is the extremely weak rule of law. Let me turn now from the economic situation just briefly to political development, briefly because there's not much to be said about it. The network of groups and clans which has gained control over the past 8 years is clearly going to seek to retain power by whatever means for as long as possible. That's got to be their bottom line. And I think they're likely to succeed in doing so for the next decade, maybe longer, unless their grip is shaken by some internal or external shock. We have to remember that Russia has never had democracy. It didn't have democracy in the 1990s. It had something that was called democracy that got itself a very bad name. And it is simply unrealistic to think of Russia making steps towards genuine democracy over the next decade, much as we would like it to happen. I can enlarge on that if you want, but I think it is not really a point that needs arguing. It therefore doesn't make a lot of sense for the West to set democracy as a short-term benchmark for judging Russia. And we must, above all, avoid pretending that democracy is there when it is not. Doesn't mean we should cease supporting the ideal or the people working for it. But while the Russian people have got equivocal views about democracy, I'm absolutely certain that they would like to have a fairer and more effective rule of law, and I think it not impossible that in the next decade we will see some development in that direction, and the beginnings of the growth of the stronger institutions which the country so clearly needs. And indeed Putin himself has recognised the need for Russia to have more than one functioning institution, which is all it has at the moment. What about relations with the outside world? There are, of course, elements in Russia, and they're no doubt well represented in the former KGB and in parts of the military, which take a primitively hardline view, which regard the West as the enemy, and which would love to rewrite the last chapter of the Cold War. These are people who would prefer isolation to integration. They would prefer confrontation to cooperation. There are, for that matter, some elements in the West, rather fewer in number, who continue to see Russia as a foe and a threat. So it's not just there. And then there are issues over which the pretty fractious East-West relationship that we have at the moment could tip into direct confrontation. This particularly applies to what Moscow calls the post-Soviet space, with problems like Georgia and Abkhazia, and indeed Ukraine, at the top of that list of issues over which we could fall apart in a very serious way. All of that said, I do not believe that confrontation is the prevailing intention of the Russian leadership. And I don't believe that for two reasons in particular. One is that both personally, as individuals in the Kremlin Inc., and nationally, they recognize that they now have a very high degree, a high level of economic interdependence with the West, and that they do not wish to sacrifice. Secondly, despite a certain amount of bluster, despite a percentage increase in the Russian defense budget, they know that in military terms, it would take many, many years to rebuild Russia as a great military power. It would require a huge diversion of resources and the sacrifice of living standards, which I don't think the Russian population would be prepared to tolerate unless they could see that there was a manifest threat which at the moment they do not perceive. So I don't see this as a country that is bent on an old-style confrontation. When you look at the focus of external policy under Putin over the last 8 years, I think it boils down to about half a dozen points. One clear objective was to reverse the humiliation of the 1990s, to restore respect for Russia, to restore Russia's position in the world, to be at the world's top tables. So getting full membership of the G8 was a very important objective. Secondly, re-establishing Russia's ability to act independently in international affairs, to be an independent power, a power which could not be taken for granted or ignored in the way that they feel they were in the 1990s, was another key objective. Being awkward, being deliberately awkward, has been one of the ways of achieving that. Thirdly, quite clearly, they are trying to leverage Russia's economic strength, and particularly in energy, rather than its military power. Fourthly, a large focus of their foreign policy is on the post-Soviet space that I talked of, where there is a clear desire to establish Russia's droit de regard, a zone of influence in this area, and to prevent further intrusion by the West, further erosion of Russia's influence in the states which used to be part of the Soviet Union or the Warsaw Pact. Fifthly, with regard to China, I think the Russians are playing a very cautious game. They are improving the relationship, increasing trade, they are cooperating where it is advantageous to do so, including at times teaming up together against Western initiatives. But at the same time, they are increasingly uncomfortable at China's rising strength, at the way that the balance of power between Russia and China has tilted and is tilting in China's direction. And that makes them fearful over the long term of what their larger neighbour might do. Finally, I think an important objective for Putin has been closer integration into the world economy, including a serious intention eventually to become members of the WTO, also of the OECD. Russian companies are being encouraged by the Kremlin to go overseas. There is a slightly grudging acceptance of the need for foreign investment in Russia, but mixed with a desire, to the extent possible, to control it. But part of the bottom line for Putin has been, and I think this is consistent throughout his time in office, that he has not wanted to confront the United States of America when push comes to shove. And I think he also sees that it is not in Russia's economic interests to confront Western Europe. I do not buy the idea which some people are promoting that Russia is now setting itself up as some kind of an alien force with an ideology of authoritarian capitalism that is opposed to Western democracy. I see Russian authoritarianism as an expedient, not an ideology. The Russians themselves actually bemoan their inability to attract people, the fact that they tend to fall back on compulsion when they're trying to move their neighbours. They can't get them into their orbit. They are conscious that they lack an ideology at the moment other than, I suppose, nationalism underpinned by Russian orthodoxy, which is not really a very exportable idea. And most interestingly, they continue to use the language of our ideology. They talk about democracy, they talk about European values as their values, they talk about the rule of law. They are not setting up alternatives to this. What we're seeing at the moment in Moscow, I think, is that the volume knob of anti-Western rhetoric is being turned down a bit, that quietly the Russian government, and I think this is as true of Putin as it is of Medvedev, are looking to rebuild relations with the West. I don't think we're going to have a big honeymoon, but I think there is an incremental process at work there. I think there is a sense that they've made their point, that they have established their independence, the respect that they wanted, they're in a stronger position, but that if they push anti-Westernism too far, that this is going to have a negative impact on their interests. I don't think that they want to push the EU or the West generally to consolidate against Russia. I think they're nervous of the mood in the United States and particularly nervous about where McCain might take America. It's interesting that they're looking to negotiate an acceptable outcome with the United States on the question of theater missile defense. They privately seem to accept that deployment in Poland and the Czech Republic is going to go ahead, and so they are focusing on establishing safeguards and confidence building measures. Let me now turn to the second part of the question, which is what the West should do. Should we be opposing Russia? Should we be treating Russia as an enemy? Or should we be treating Russia as a strategic partner or something else in between? I think the problem with Western policy is that over the last 10 or 15 years, it's been disunited, it's been inconsistent, and it has at times been highly unrealistic. In the 1990s, I think we made a number of strategic errors. There was a naive belief that Russia could make an instant transition, which underestimated the depth and the trauma of what was actually happening following the collapse of the Soviet Union. There was a rose-tinted view of Boris Yeltsin. There was an exaggerated belief that the West could have a major influence over his administration and Russia's internal development. There was the premature and wishful assertion stemming from that, that we were now strategic partners with shared interests and common values, which clearly we were not and we still are not. And then there was the whole policy of NATO enlargement, on which I will say a little bit more in a minute. The net result of this was a lot of disillusionment on both sides, what Solzhenitsyn has called the clash of illusory hopes against reality. The price of strategic partnership was simply not one that Russia was prepared to pay. So what we now need is a different strategy, a strategy that is founded on a much more realistic appreciation, and one which distinguishes between our long-term aspirations for our relationship with Russia and what is necessary and achievable in the short term. As far as the long term is concerned, I have no problem with an aspiration to a strategic partnership founded on shared interests and common values when we can achieve it. 20 years or so from now, we could conceivably find ourselves much closer to it. And that could embrace a much closer relationship between the European Union and Russia, but not one which we can begin to define now. But what is realistic for the short term, for the next 4 to 8 years? And here I will offer you, I think, 9 points before I conclude. Firstly, we must recognise, as I say, that our ability to influence developments within Russia is very limited. There are certain ways in which we can have both a positive and a negative influence, but they are at the margins. We can't dictate it. Secondly, that means that we must deal with Russia as it is, not as we would wish it to be. I believe that it is likely that the modernizing forces will eventually grow in strength in Russia, but this isn't going to happen very quickly. And really, we're not going to see it happen very much, unless I'm too pessimistic, over the next 3 to 4 years. I think that serious change in Russia is more likely to have to wait for the incremental emergence of a genuinely post-Soviet ruling and managerial class, and that will be a process that begins to be more apparent 10 years or so from now, simply for reasons of people's age. Thirdly, I see no need for us to confront Russia for the simple reason that Russia does not pose a general threat to us. Following from that, I think we need to avoid the sort of approaches which play into the hands of Russian hardliners. Isolating Russia, drawing new dividing lines across Europe, empowers those people. It removes our leverage, and ultimately it is very harmful to our best interests. Fourthly, where we find, as we do find, that Russia opposes our interests or our values, we need to be very firm in our defence. And that means standing very resolutely by the sovereignty of the post-Soviet states, and it means standing very firmly for the rule of law, both internationally and indeed in this country. Because it's the rule of law that has been in question in the series of events over the past 5 years. It's been the linking factor between those events, the events which have created tension in our bilateral relations with Russia from the Zakhaev extradition case onwards. And this is not something where we can compromise. Fifthly, I think we have a tendency, which one can see very markedly in the European Union, to overestimate Russia's strength and to underestimate our own. Russia depends more on the European Union than vice versa. Well over half of her exports go to the EU. We should not run scared of Russian energy muscle, because Gazprom's profits depend almost entirely on exports to the EU, and as yet it has no alternative export market. Russian energy companies need Western finance, and increasingly, as oil becomes and gas become harder to find in Russia, in more difficult areas and offshore, they need Western technology. Sixthly, NATO enlargement. We've got ourselves into a box over this. I yield to no one in my support for the sovereign rights of the Baltic states and the other new members of NATO, but I question whether NATO has significantly enhanced the security that they have anyway as members of the United Nations and indeed as members of the European Union. You can take an analogy from Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait, a UN member, not a NATO member, and the reaction to it. Do we really believe that Russia would consider invading a member state of the European Union? NATO did not need new members. What NATO needed after the end of the Cold War was a new doctrine and a new rationale, which it now has. But its expansion along Russia's borders appeared to the Russians to conflict with the new rationale that they were being told that NATO had, especially as NATO leaders had given certain assurances to the Russians in the early 1990s about the stationing of forces, which appear not to have been fully respected. The rush to incorporate as many former Soviet satrapies as offered themselves into NATO looked to Moscow awfully like the old zero-sum rationale of the Cold War. The other thing that NATO needs is capabilities. And to be brutally frank, the new members have not added a great deal to NATO's capabilities. We now have a situation where NATO is overstretched in Afghanistan and its capabilities are insufficient, above all because of the failure of the older, richer, older established European members to put adequate resources into defence. We're taking a free ride on the Americans. Enlargement in all of this is a red herring. Now we have some NATO members pressing for Georgia and Ukraine to be given membership action programs in December. Indeed, they wanted it to happen at Bucharest the other day. And we must ask ourselves, does this really make sense? If you set Russia's views entirely on one side for the moment, is Georgia going to enhance NATO? Is Georgia a stable, mature democracy with settled borders? Can the already overstretched NATO afford to be drawn into another unstable region and into a confrontation with Russia and into conflicts which it cannot control? And what about Ukraine? Is Ukraine a stable and mature democracy? Does the Ukrainian leadership have a democratic mandate for seeking membership? Does a clear majority of the Ukrainian population support this? The opinion polls point very firmly in the other way. Is this therefore an issue which could actually tear Ukraine apart? Now, there are two arguments in favour of Georgian and Ukrainian membership. One is that it's hard to say no, and the other is that we need to stand up to Russian pressure on those countries. But there are many other ways in which the West can support Georgia and Ukraine. We need to consider what is in NATO's best interests, and the answer to me is pretty clear. Now is not the time. Then if we do turn to the effect on Russia, well, this is fissile material. In present circumstances, prospective Ukrainian membership of NATO would raise enormous risks. No Russian leadership could afford to acquiesce in it. It is not a sellable proposition inside Russia. So I firmly believe that we need to change the terms of the debate about NATO. I think the EU should come before NATO with regard to those countries. And as the German Chancellor wisely suggested last week, a much stronger NATO-Russia relationship should precede further talk of enlargement. Let me turn now to the European Union. The European Union needs somehow or another to find a way of acting together with regard to Russia. Because with the partial exception of Germany, no EU member state is strong enough to pursue an effective policy on its own. And this has got implications for the UK, as well as for those who are prone to cut deals at the expense of the common interest. There are analysts who've identified up to five different approaches to Russia within the EU. But we have to bear in mind that when the EU has succeeded in acting together, as it did over the last enlargement and Kaliningrad, and as it has done repeatedly over trade, it has proved remarkably effective in dealing with Russia. The Russians may not like EU solidarity. Putin has publicly complained about it, but they have a grudging respect for it. The EU's most glaring weakness is the absence of a common energy policy, and repairing this should be one of our highest priorities in relations with Russia. Not, I believe, securing a new partnership and cooperation agreement. A disproportionate amount of effort has gone into simply agreeing on the mandate under which the EU is going to negotiate. What we've got to avoid is the impulse to sign an agreement at any price. We need better cooperation with Russia in many discrete areas. We need implementation of the unfulfilled parts of earlier agreements. What we do not necessarily need is a grandiose new agreement declaring a strategic partnership which doesn't actually exist. It would be better to have no agreement than one which lacks realism and does not achieve tangible results. Eighthly, the USA and the G8. I would not endorse everything that President Bush has said about Russia, especially when he peers into people's souls, but I think he does deserve marks for continuing to engage on strategic issues as he did at the recent Sochi and last year's Kennebunkport summits. Russia has genuine strategic concerns, and these should not be ignored. Insofar as one can determine it, Senator Obama's position seems to be in favour of a continuing critical engagement with Russia. But McCain, what about McCain? He seems to me to be fascinatingly contradictory, perhaps reflecting a wider debate in the United States. He has called, as I said earlier, for Russia to be excluded from the G8 and for Brazil and India to be invited. Now, the first part of that is simply not realistic. There is no mechanism for excluding a country from the G8, and it simply won't happen. The second part has a lot to be said for it. Indeed, we recommended it 2 years ago in our report, though you would surely have to invite China as well. Now, last week, McCain has veered from the right of Bush on the G8 to the left of Bush on arms control, calling for a new legally binding agreement to be negotiated with Russia to reduce nuclear arsenals, which is precisely the approach that Bush abandoned right at the beginning of his term in office. I suspect that this is a better clue than the G8 rhetoric to the approach which McCain would take if elected, but I'm in no position to know. That brings me naturally to Iran. Iran, like Ukraine, has the potential to be a showstopper in our relations with Russia. The Russians trade opportunistically with Iran, including in the civil nuclear area and in armaments, but they're not fans of their regime, and they have as many reasons as the rest of us not to want Iran to become a military nuclear power. They've essentially used their relationship with Iran as a bargaining chip with the USA and the West, but when push has come to shove, they have tended to join with us at the UN. However, when you talk to them about this, they're not at all optimistic that Iran's nuclear ambitions can be blocked, and they therefore seem to be inclining towards a plan B for seeking to embrace Iran in safeguards and the international status quo. What seems absolutely clear is that an American strike against Iran, were it to happen, would push the Russians right over onto the Iranian side. They don't believe that it would achieve its objectives. They greatly fear the consequences that it would have. Finally, wider engagement. While we wait in hope for benevolent change and modernization in Russia, let us not assume that everything depends on politics. Despite many negative occurrences, including the constriction of political debate, of the media, of NGOs, of the British Council, and so on, there are still vast areas of Western contact and engagement with Russia and with Russians of many kinds, in business, in education, and in myriad personal contacts. And all of this to an extent that was simply unimaginable in Soviet times. And I think we should never forget that sustaining this is something that we can do and should do, and that again should be one of our priorities. So I conclude that Russia is not yet a genuine strategic partner, whatever that may mean, that if it were not already a G8 member, it is unlikely that Russia would have received an invitation to next month's summit, and that there are grounds for concern over a great deal that has happened and is happening in Russia, but that nevertheless we have no choice but to continue to deal realistically with Russia, as we do, say, with China, and that we must factor time into our thinking. A few months ago, the former Prime Minister in Russia, Yegor Gaidar, likened Russia's present condition to adolescence. Let us not forget that barely half a generation has passed since the Russians experienced the most sudden and dramatic upheavals to affect any large nation in peacetime in the modern era. And it's going to take much longer than half a generation for that country to settle into its new pattern. Thank you very much.